Good morning, Park City. And this is Mountain Money. I'm Kevin Kennedy, and Roger Goldman's on vacation still. He'll be back next week. Today on Mountain Money, we have David M. Rubenstein, an encore performance with his new book, The Highest Calling. Then we have Brendan and Carly Coyle of Dendrick Estates. We'll discuss their new cider estate in Camas. And we'll end the hour with Rhonda Sedaris and Helena Sedaris of Park City Lodging, celebrating 40 years in business.
In November 2022, we were fortunate to have David Rubenstein join us on Mountain Money to describe his book, How to Invest. Now, Rubenstein has a new book out on the American presidency, The Highest Calling. We're pleased to welcome him back to the program this morning. Good morning, David, and thanks for joining us.
My pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
You know, the book has a remarkable structure in that it features a number of interviews of noted scholars and living presidents. How long have you been interested in the presidency, and what motivated you to structure the book in that fashion?
Well, when I was a little boy, I saw John Kennedy drive past my neighborhood in his car on his way to an event, and he was campaigning for president. And so ever since that time, I've probably been interested in the presidency. And as a young man, I wanted to work in the White House, and I was very fortunate to work for President Carter for 4 years in the White House. And since that time, I've lived in Washington. And so when you live in Washington, you tend to get to know people work on White House staffs, and I get to know the presidents. And I've known all the presidents since Jimmy Carter, some better than others, and some I've worked with more closely than others. But I've just had a fascination with the White House and the presidency, I guess.
Outstanding. Now, you start with a chapter on George Washington. How significant was his role in defining the nature of the U.S. government?
Well, had Washington not agreed to be president, he didn't want to be president because no male member of his family had ever lived past 50, and he was 57 at the time. He didn't think he had long to live. But he agreed to do it, and he didn't really like the job, and after a couple of months, he was going to quit, but he was talked into staying, and then he didn't want to get reelected, but he was talked into doing a second term, and finally, after the second term, he said, I'm out of here. I think he set the tone. He made it not a royal kind of job. People thought that he should be called Your Majesty, Your Highness, but he said, no, just call me Mr. President. And that's the title that we still have for President of the United States. He was not a poor man. He was a wealthy man, but he wanted to kind of have an image of the presidency as being somebody that was accessible to people. And so he made himself available to people. People could come to meet with him from time to time. And I think he set the tone for the presidency. And I think some of the things he innovated and did at the time that were unique were those things we still do today.
Can you give us some examples?
Well, for example, of course, resigning after two terms is one example. But he also, he did consult with Congress on appointments and things like that, as members do. And he did obey the advise and consent the provisions of the Constitution. He honored them, even though from time to time he was frustrated with it. He did tend to want to know people in the country, so he spent time visiting all parts of the country, which people who are present still do. He did spend time socializing in Washington because he thought that that's the best way to know other people and can give people his views were to be the social. So he was quite social in that respect. And he, remember, there was no television, no radio. So if you want to get your views out, you had to socialize with people, and he was willing to do that. I think he was a president who really set the tone for a lot of other presidents that have come along, which is to say, be informed about things, be a leader, but be modest and humble to some extent. And while all of our presidents weren't that way, I think many of the most admired presidents have had a certain amount of humility to them.
You know, you mentioned the two-term decision. In the 18th century, I suspect that that was critically important in sort of distinguishing between the concept of a constitutional republic and a monarchy. And that tradition lasted a long time. Is that your sense as well, that decision not to stay on after two terms was very important in terms of defining the role of the presidency?
Well, at the Constitutional Convention, some people like Alexander Hamilton thought the president should stay forever. The Constitution did not put in term limits in. And so now we have term limits, but that was not the time. And George Washington was somebody who wanted to make certain that we didn't have a king. So that's why he didn't really want to stay forever, or did he not want anybody in his family to succeed him? There was never any discussion of that. But he could have said, look, I want somebody in my family to succeed me, or I want to stay until I die. But he didn't do that. And I think we give him a lot of credit for that.
Yeah. Now, so you mentioned that he's on the road, traveling around, meeting people. About what percentage of the time would you say he would be traveling around the country to meet people?
Well, remember, at the time he was president, he was president in New York and then Philadelphia. Those were the capitals of the country. He did actually select the site there. The capital now is Washington, D.C., as we call it. But it was his decision to locate it there. He felt that he should visit all parts of the country that he was the president of, and so he did spend time. And it wasn't that easy in those days. They didn't have jet airplanes or railroads, so we had to go by horseback, more or less. And he was a skilled horseman, but still, took a long time. It could take a couple of weeks to go from Philadelphia to Washington, D.C. by horseback.
Many of the chapters focus on particular elements of a presidency. I think you mentioned the book that there have been some 16,000 books written on Abraham Lincoln. You interviewed
right.
Ted Widmer, who wrote an entire book on a 13-day trip from Springfield to Washington.
Right.
Why was that trip so important, and what does it tell us about the unique challenges faced by
many,
Lincoln?
Well, many books about Lincoln are well-known and have been around for a long time. Doris Kearns Goodwin did a terrific one on Lincoln, and obviously Carl Sandburg did another famous one. There are lots of great books about him. But this is one that I read where I didn't know much about it before, and I thought many other people didn't either. And what it's about is the trip that Lincoln took from Springfield to get to Washington, D.C., very circuitous route. He had to go on the circuitous route because he had to avoid going to the Confederate States because they might have assassinated him. And there was an assassination plot that he had to worry about when he went through Baltimore. But he made speeches. He got identified he had helped identify himself to people more because most people had never seen him before. He was a relatively unknown person. And so he made speeches in lots of interesting cities and made speeches at Independence Hall in Philadelphia, made a major speech in New York and smaller cities. And he met a lot of famous people during the time of that trip. And I thought it was an unusual story that I hadn't been that familiar with. I thought other readers would enjoy it as well.
And what did he communicate during those speeches? This is obviously a fraught time for the Republic. How is he setting the tone for his upcoming administration?
Well, remember, some southern states had already seceded. So he was trying to say, I haven't done anything that should make the South worried. He was not an abolitionist. He did not believe in abolishing slavery. His view at that time was that slavery had already been in the Constitution, and so it had to be left alone. His view was that in new states that were going to join the Union, they should not have slavery in them. That was very upsetting to the southern states because they thought that eventually they would be surrounded by states that did not have slavery, and eventually those states would overwhelm them in the Congress and so forth, and slavery would eventually be eliminated. That's why they were so upset with Lincoln, because he didn't want slavery in the new states, and they thought eventually that would come to take away their livelihood as well, with the people who were the slave owners. But Lincoln ultimately came around to the need to get rid of slavery, and he did that through the Emancipation Proclamation. But that was really done as much to win the war as anything else, because it enabled about 200,000 freed slaves to fight for the Union, which they did.
One of the details that caught my eyes, it was apparently a notation that John Wilkes Booth was actually present at one of those early speeches.
John Wilkes Booth was one of the speeches. He was an actor, and he was at one of the speeches that Lincoln gave on his trip to Washington, D.C. And actually, John Wilkes Booth was at another occasion, I think right before Lincoln was assassinated by John Wilkes Booth. After the 13th Amendment had been approved by the Senate, the House, and it was then going to go to the states for ratification, Lincoln gave us a little talk at the White House in front of people, and he said something to the effect that he thought maybe it would be the case that some educated freed slaves would be eligible to vote. Not everybody who was a freed slave, but some educated ones or certain appropriate ones. That's so upset John Wilkes Booth that he resolved right then that he had to assassinate Lincoln, because he didn't think that former slaves should ever have the right to vote, let alone any other rights.
And at that time, Booth was the most popular actor in America. Is that right?
Yes. His father and his brother were extremely popular actors, and John Wilkes Booth was also a very popular actor, a very skilled Shakespearean actor. And that it was his ability to as an actor that was so well known that when he went to Ford Theater that night, he could get through normal security guards because people just thought he was there as part of his career. Interestingly, as I point out in the book, Lincoln invited Ulysses S. Grant to go with him to the Ford Theater that night, but Mrs. Grant did not like Mrs. Lincoln, felt he was very difficult to deal with. So they came up with an excuse that they had to be out of town, which they did. They went to New Jersey by train. And so therefore, the entire military entourage that would have accompanied Ulysses S. Grant to Ford Theater was not there. And therefore, John Wilkes Booth had an easy entry into the balcony that Lincoln was sitting at. So we'll always wonder if John Wilkes Booth had not been able to get in, would Lincoln have survived? How would the country have been different? How would Reconstruction have been different? Obviously, we'll never know the answers to that.
Yeah, indeed. What made Lincoln so special that he was able to successfully navigate the Civil War?
Lincoln had a certain humility about him. He didn't brag about things. He had a certain sense of humor. He realized he came from a very modest background. And he didn't brag about things and so forth. He didn't run around the White House saying, look, I just won the Civil War. Aren't I great? Or I gave the Gettysburg Address. Isn't that a great speech? Very modest, good sense of humor. But he also was willing to listen to other people. And he didn't think he knew all the answers. And so he didn't have an arrogance that you might have brought to the table if you were president of the United States. So I think he had a lot of great skills. And, you know, he was killed at the age of 56 years old. That's it, 56.
We could probably talk about Lincoln for the rest of the time we have together, but let's move on to Woodrow Wilson. He had an unlikely and crazy meteoric rise to the presidency. He obviously hoped the League of Nations would be a signature achievement, but then his health problems happened. What happened, and how did the government function?
Well, what happened was that Woodrow Wilson was only served 2 years as governor of New Jersey and got elected president of the United States after just 2 years as governor of New Jersey. So that's an amazing rise, you might say. When he was elected president, he was seen as a progressive, a liberal Democrat. But he had some Southern roots, and the result was he was very interested in resegregating the workforce in the federal government. But what you're referring to is that he had a stroke. He was trying to get the League of Nations approved as part of the Treaty of Versailles. He wanted to get Congress to approve the League of Nations, his idea of the kind of equivalent of the UN. And he went on a railroad trip around the country. During that time, he suffered a stroke, and he later had another more severe stroke. And he basically was incapacitated physically for 18 months of his presidency, the last 18 months. So he had his wife more or less serving as the de facto president because she was reviewing the papers that came to him, and she was deciding what he should see and not see, and probably she was making some decisions for him. So it was a very unfortunate situation because, you know, we didn't elect her president of the United States. She didn't really have any government background at all. And so she was making decisions. And I think as a result of that stroke and the way Wilson handled it and the result of this resegregating the federal workforce, he is not considered the great president that he once was considered. And in fact, the Woodrow Wilson School at Princeton has been renamed. They've taken the name off. And some other things that were named after Wilson are no longer named after him.
One of the details that I had never heard before was this image of Wilson trying to deceive legislators who come to see him by, you know, accentuating the one side of his body that could function. What kinds of things did he do to try to convince people that he was still in control?
Well, when he would invite, very rarely, but he'd have members of Congress, a few members of Congress would deign to ask if they could see him from time to time, just make sure they could tell their constituents, yes, they've met the president and this is what he wants to do. Or sometimes occasionally his cabinet officer would be asked to see him to make sure they knew what he wanted. Mrs. Wilson would prop him up in the bed and kind of make him look like by putting pillows in the right direction and having the light in the right direction or not having light in certain areas, it would look like he could function and like he could move his body when in fact he really couldn't move his body very much at all. And so it was very deceptive and it's unfortunate that it happened, but that was the case.
Did he really contemplate running for a third term?
In the book that I interviewed the author of, Scott Berg, who is a Pulitzer Prize winning author, he did speak about it, but nobody took him seriously who knew his health situation. So he talked about it. Maybe it was just because he was so out of touch with reality that he talked about it. So I don't think it was ever really seriously entertained that he would run for a third term.
Yeah. Now, Jonathan Darman argues that FDR's polio was fundamental to the development of his character. How did he contract the disease, and how do you think it affected his development as a leader?
Roosevelt had a family compound in Campobello, which is a little island off the coast of Canada, honestly, not really in the United States. The family had a vacation there for many years. He contracted it maybe at a Boy Scout event that he went to, where he was in the water and maybe contracted it there. It's not quite clear where he contracted it, but the first signs of polio came when he was at Campobello, where he couldn't really walk so well. His legs were hurting him, and he kind of just felt he needed more rest. For 30 days, he wasn't getting really good medical treatment, and people didn't know what he had. But when they finally figured it out that it was polio, it was too late to really correct the problem. Had it been known as polio in the first day or two of his contracting it, it's possible that they could have cured it, not cured it, but it could have made it possible for him to walk again. But because his legs became so weakened after 30 days, he was never able to walk again, even though he tried to give the appearance that he could. But the Jonathan Darman's thesis is that Roosevelt was not all that gifted intellectually and wasn't taken seriously as a leader by many of his peers, and therefore probably not likely to ever be president of the United States. But by contracting polio, he developed a tougher character. He developed more resilience. He developed more of ability of fighting for something. And as a result, he was willing to take on the challenge of getting elected governor of New York and then president of the United States. So his thesis, which may have some merit to it, is that the polio, while it's a terrible thing for Roosevelt himself to have had it, it no doubt made him stronger than he would have otherwise been and probably wouldn't have been president or a successful president had he not had polio.
And how do you think historians will view his term as president in terms of importance?
I'm sorry.
How do you think historians will view his terms as president in terms of importance?
Roosevelt?
Yes.
Well, Roosevelt served for president longer than anybody else, and he did two things that were really essential to the country. He got us out of the Depression, which Herbert Hoover was unable to really do, and he helped win the Second World War. He died before the war was truly won in near Europe or in Asia, but he pretty much had the pieces in place, and so Truman really was following up on what Roosevelt had done. Roosevelt will be certainly considered by all historians as one of the most significant persons to ever have been president. Remember, he was president for a little bit more than 12 years. Nobody else had ever done that. And getting us through the Depression and World War II, I don't think anybody else had to face so issues so consequential as those were. And so I think Roosevelt will certainly go down in the panoply as one of the greatest presidents we ever had.
Yeah. Now, how did, moving on to Kennedy, how did JFK handle the two big crises of his presidency, A, the Bay of Pigs, and B, the Cuban Missile Crisis?
The Bay of Pigs was an effort by former Cuban citizens to take back control of the government. It had been started by the CIA, and Eisenhower had known about it when he was president, but he never actually gave the approval to do it. When Kennedy became president, he basically was asked to approve it, and he, feeling that he couldn't go against what Eisenhower had presumably, he thought, wanted, and what the CIA had developed, so he went along with it. But he realized pretty readily that it was a disaster afterwards, and he went on TV and said, "I take full responsibility." Ever since that time, presidents have done that. Why? When they make a big mistake, because when you take responsibility, his polling went up. In other words, Kennedy did a terrible thing. He didn't know what he was doing. He didn't provide the air cover that the Cuban rebels wanted. But his popularity went up when he took the responsibility for it. Ever since then, politicians have said, well, I'm going to take responsibility. Maybe my popularity will go up as a result. But the thing that he did that was really good. And, of course, what people say is, I take responsibility, but I really wasn't my fault. It wasn't my fault. They hope their popularity go up, but they really don't want to get blamed. many times that has worked, but sometimes it doesn't. But what he really did that was the most brilliant thing in his presidency was when missiles were put into Cuba, nuclear missiles, he was able to, over a 13-day period of time, figure out a way to get Khrushchev to back down and take the missiles away. However, it wasn't a perfect situation. We didn't realize it at the time, but the strategic intercontinental missiles, the nuclear-tipped intercontinental missiles that Khrushchev dissembled and took back, he did not take back the tactical nuclear weapons that were still in Cuba, which we didn't know about at the time. Oh. We learned about it later. And those tactical nuclear weapons were withdrawn later only because Khrushchev had the view that, Castro was unreliable and crazy, and therefore he didn't want Castro to have the ability to use those weapons. But it wasn't because we did the nuclear, we did the Cuban Missile Crisis so well. So, but leaving that aside, Kennedy was able to talk us down from a nuclear confrontation. I remember as a boy, I was in school, and I can't believe this now, but my teacher said, I don't think we're going to be here tomorrow because we're going to have a nuclear weapon going off in our country, and therefore there's no homework. It's hard to believe that the teacher would say that, but I distinctly remember saying no homework. So, and I also remember as a boy, because we were worried about nuclear bombs going off and maybe in the Cuban Missile Crisis, we were practicing sitting under our desk. I don't know if you guys are probably old enough to remember this, but you were supposed to practice getting under your desk as if a nuclear weapon, when it went off, would not have radiation that would kill you.
Exactly. That provided some security.
The book is The Highest Calling. It's a remarkable book. David Rubenstein, I wish we had more time to talk about it. Thanks for spending time with us this morning.
Thank you. My pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Enjoy your day.
And I'm luckily joined by Brendan and Carly Coyle of Dendrick Estates. Good morning, you two.
Good morning.
There you are.
All right, new with the board here. So Dendrick Estates, very cool name. Let's start off with what is Dendrick Estates and why you decided to start the business?
Yeah, so Dendrick Estate is a 20-acre mountain cider and spirits estate located right in the center of the Camas Valley, just 20 minutes east of Park City. And honestly, like, I've been in Elk Bev, we've been in the business for a while now, and what we've never really had in our previous, ventures and businesses is that connection of agriculture to the beverage. And that's where that idea really germinated from, is to bring the agriculture to the beverage, have it all located on one site, just like an estate winery.
So in your past, how was that not connected?
So I started life in the brewing industry. In the brewing industry, you're bringing in grains from afar, let's just say, and they're malted from afar, and you bring them in, and you don't have the agriculture right on site. And that's kind of the focus that's the beauty of estate wineries. It's the beauty of what we're doing out there in the Camas Valley, is that we have a good chunk of the agriculture right there on site. And then after the brewing industry, I transitioned over to the distilling industry. And again, you have kind of grains from afar, but you're never like in the barley fields, you're never in the rye fields, so to speak.
These
distilleries are not. But what you can do up here, it's a little bit too high in elevation for a winery to have a vineyard up here at 6,500 feet in elevation. But what you can do is you can have a really nice estate orchard to make great dry mountain ciders. And so that's how the idea came to be, have a certain amount of the agriculture right there on site, like a winery, invite people in for tastings, and have it all in one place.
Nice. So it's an apple orchard.
It is, yeah. It's a high-density apple orchard. So we're on trellised apples. So they're basically, it actually looks more like a vineyard than an apple orchard, to be totally honest. You're on this high-density planting. The trees are supported by wire and trellis posts. And so you actually get a higher yield per unit acre, and it's easier to manage and much more efficient to manage that way.
Is it so you don't need a ladder?
That's correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it's low and it's easy to pick the fruit.
Yep, absolutely. The trees only get to be about 10 feet tall.
Okay.
And you want to do as many activities via tractor as possible, so it's more efficient with your labor and with your time. And so that's why I say it almost kind of looks more like a vineyard than an apple orchard, because you have these trellised rows that are very tight together. They're only about 12 feet apart.
Oh, good. Easy to water then.
Easy to water, yep.
Uh-huh. Nice. Now, how big is Dendrick?
So Dendrick is a 20-acre estate. We'll have about 5 acres all developed out with a production house and a tasting room. And the other 15 acres will all be high-density orchard, planted all around the outdoor event space right on the estate.
And that'll be more apples.
That's right, yeah. We've actually been trialing over 30 different varietals in an R&D orchard that we've had for 4 years on the property. And we'll take all the trials and all the research that we've done, and that pairs all the way down to just 3 or 4 different varietals that we'll plant out across the 15 acres.
Gotcha. So how old are the trees then? 4 years?
Yeah, so it's a mix. So we've done a lot of different plantings and ran a lot of different trials over the past 4 years. And every year we've planted something. You know, some years were a lot, some years were very, very little. And along with the varietals, we're also testing different irrigation methods and different farming methods to go along with it. So if you come out and you visit the orchard, you know, you'll notice it almost looks kind of patchwork because there's a lot of different trials going on right now. But now we've answered most of the questions and we're in this kind of like scale up time right now. And so now we'll start doing some much larger plantings focused on the most successful methods that we've trialed over the past 4 years.
Nice. So I always thought apples took 10 years to start producing fruit. How are they producing fruit so quickly?
Well, they do in like a traditional orchard. So when you think about, you know, when a lot of people think of an apple orchard, they think of those big 30, 40 foot tall, big round trees, a lot of space in between them, everything like that. And that's where the industry started, right? Homestead orchards like that. But as the technology has come into play and as we've gotten better at how we do things in the agricultural world, it's moved more and more towards high density orchards like this. And it's really mainly two reasons. Number one, you can come into fruit bearing years faster. And number two, you can yield more fruit per unit acre. And that's the two biggest reasons why it's been going this way over the years.
Perfect.
Yeah, so we actually come to bear fruit in about 3 years. And the trees are full capacity at about year 5 or 6.
And how long do they live or, you know, keep producing?
Yeah, it really kind of depends on the varietal and how you get things set up. But basically about 30, maybe 40 years on dwarf fruit stock on a high-density orchard like that.
Outstanding.
Yeah.
What's the most popular apple you have grown now?
Oh, that's up for debate.
How about most populous?
Yeah. Well, I'll talk about... Let me talk about one that's really interesting that a lot of people don't know much about, and that's red flesh fruit. Now, there exist different varietals of apples out there. They're actually red flesh, like a cherry, red flesh on the inside, so you can make this beautiful, dry, sparkling rosé cider. And it's 100% natural color coming from the fruit because it's actually red inside as opposed to like the typical yellow inside the fruit that you would see from the fruit coming from the grocery store. And we'll be planting about 1,600 or so of those trees just starting in 2026. The name of the varietal is Redfield. We're pretty excited about it.
Redfield.
Yeah.
Nice. How many trees per acre?
We're right at about 1,000 trees an acre is our density, which is, you know, it's high density, but nowadays you're seeing the biggest, you know, most tightly managed orchards for production fruit, for grocery stores and things like that. You're seeing those at like 16, 17, 800, 1,800 trees per acre.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Wow.
It's gotten pretty wild.
Yeah, that gets out there. Yeah. So, cider, you said it's kind of like wine, so it's fermented.
That's correct, yeah.
Okay, and the beer was brewed that you did, and then the spirits are distilled. Tell me a little bit about the difference in brewing compared to fermenting, compared to distilling, time and effort and such.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's something that we love to talk about because I think that cider gets kind of paired with and compared against beer all the time out in America, when in reality it has far more in common with a nice, dry, sparkling wine. The only difference is we're making our wine from apples versus grapes. In the beer industry, it's coming from grains, you know, malted barley, and different hops are added to the brewing process. So you're actually boiling the batch of beer, adding in hops. There's a lot more steps to the process. In wine and in cider, you're taking that fruit and you're juicing that fruit to get all that juice coming from the fruit. You're not adding any water at all. You just want that pure juice coming from the fruit. And that's how you make great wines. It's how you make great ciders. On the distilling side of things, you take it one step further and you actually distill that beer, like whiskey, or that wine, which would be brandy, and you distill it off. You take the alcohol, boil the alcohol out of the wine or the beer, and you age that in barrels for years, at least months, if not many, many years. And that's the big difference there, is taking it one step further to that distillation step.
Okay. Now, wine is sometimes aged in barrels, right?
It is, yeah, it is. And we'll be doing a little bit of that on our estate as well. Shorter duration, you know, like whereas a whiskey or something like that, you'd see that go 4, 5, 6 plus years. Mm-hmm. On the wine side, you're focused on a shorter time. So it's more like 1, maybe 2 years is kind of typical for like a barrel-aged wine.
And if it's sparkling, it obviously has effervescence, and that can go in a wooden barrel without kind of leaking out the effervescence?
Well, the sparkling comes later. So we don't have sparkling yet when it goes into the barrel. It goes into the barrel uncarbonated.
Okay.
When it comes out of the barrel down the road, that's when you're blending together different batches to get balance, and then you're adding carbonation, or you're having a secondary fermentation via yeast. So it's another fermentation, but as opposed to focused on making the alcohol in the second fermentation, you're focused on making the carbonation, and you're holding that carbonation in the bottle.
Nice, you're not just injecting CO2.
Yeah, I mean, that's one way to do it. Yeah. A little bit better way to do it is that secondary fermentation. You get a cleaner, softer carbonation. It's more pleasing and smoother on your palate.
And is that what they do in France with champagne?
That's exactly how champagne is made, yeah. Champagne has that secondary fermentation, and they capture that inside the bottle. And that's actually a really long process, too. It's in the bottle on the order of years in many cases.
Years?
Years, indeed.
Wow. Yeah. Now, are there going to be single batch ciders? Oh,
absolutely, yeah.
Like a Macintosh single batch.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Single varietal is really, you've seen it in the wine industry for forever, mm-hmm. right? Single varietal wines. Well, you have single varietal ciders, too. And as cider is kind of becoming more of this higher end, more wine focused product, you see single varietals coming out, and you see different types of varietals really showcased very, very well on their own. Kingston Black is actually a really good example of that. It's an apple varietal that comes out of the UK, and it's known for being very well balanced across acids and tannins and flavor profile in the fruit, where it shows very well on its own, no need for blending. And so a lot of people do single varietal Kingstons, and we'll probably be doing that as well.
And just to relate it back to the wine industry as well, so ciders, apples that work well for ciders are going to be high in acid, high in tannins. So they're not the type of apples that you'll see just in your grocery store. So these varietals that Brendan is mentioning, like Kingston Black and Virginia Hughes Crab, those type of varietals aren't great for eating, but they have the right acids and tannins that work really well for cider. Similar to the wine industry, mm-hmm. you have, you know, your table grapes that you would buy in the grocery store, and then you have your Merlot grapes or your Cab Sav or your Pinot Grigio grapes. And they're not really great for eating, but they make fantastic wines.
Gotcha.
I love this. You just like jumped right into the tech. Like, let's get right into the details.
I know. So you're the maker, and you're the brains behind the operation.
That's perfect. I love it.
That works.
I love it.
Yep.
Got it. And so who's the farmer? Both?
It's kind of both.
It's been both.
A little while ago, it was neither, and now it's both. So we started Dendrick Estate when we purchased the property back in 2019, okay? It was November of 2019.
Nice timing.
We all know what happened several months later. And so we really took COVID as an opportunity where we really just hunkered down. We became night and weekend farmers, and we figured it all out. Because there's really no playbook for what we're doing, where we're doing it. You know, there's growing high-density cider varietal fruit at 6,500 feet in elevation. It's just not really done in our area. So we had to figure it all out, you know, from the varietals to the farming methods to irrigation, all of that. And so we spent those next 3 or 4 years figuring it all out. And so now the production house is open. We're in crush and press literally starting this week. And we're off to the races, and products will be available the spring of 25.
And I do want to give a shout out to our first employee. We just hired our first employee a few months ago. We're so excited. Marina Miller is our estate horticulturist.
Excellent.
So she is now in charge of keeping the orchard healthy and green and just managing it overall. And she's doing a fantastic job. We're so lucky to have her on our team.
Outstanding. Holy cow. Now, so you mush it, you're going to mush the stuff. You're going to make the...
You crush. We're going to get the terms down here, okay? You crush the fruit.
I had the USH part. wrong beginning. So you crush it, and then the remnants you can make a brandy out of.
You could, yeah. And so once you crush the fruit and you extract the juices, right, and then you ferment those juices to become cider, you can take the pomace, and you can actually rehydrate that, and you can distill that off to be a type of brandy that is done. But what we'll be focused on is really that will go to compost to really regenerate the soils. We have some significant sustainability initiatives on the estate. That's one of them, really regenerative farming, making the soils better, you know, building the soils back better than they were when you came to find them. That's a really big part of our plan. Another one is water conservation and water reuse, so.
How do you reuse the water?
So we just finished installing, we just finished commissioning an aerobic digestion system that will aerobically digest and filter 100% of our wastewater. And we're jumping into the permitting process now with the state of Utah to get permitted so we can take that now digested and filtered wastewater and pump that back to the orchard and use it as irrigation water.
Interesting. And so is it drip irrigation? Because that's supposed to be...
It's going to be a mix of both. So we'll have some drip there. We'll also have some like micro sprinklers. In the outdoor event space, we'll be interested in having some green row middles so people can really enjoy the orchard. You know, we can do events, do tastings, dinners in the orchard. Across other parts of the orchard, we will have drip irrigation so we can be more water conscious.
I'm loving this already. I can't wait to try. When can I try it?
So products hit the shelves. We're shooting for about kind of May, June timeframe of next year. So 2025 is when we ferment through the winter. We get all of our stuff going through the winter. And then we'll be products on the shelves May, June of 2025. We also have this tasting room plan, an event space and tasting room on the estate. We're shooting for the back half of next year to have that open, but stay tuned on that one because we're still working out the details on it.
So next harvest season, hopefully.
That's the goal.
Exactly.
Are there tours allowed?
Yeah, once we get the tasting room open, we will have a tour option available. Probably a few different tours, one that would go through the orchard, one that would just go through the process, a longer one where you could do a tasting with Brendan. So we'll definitely be bringing people out as much as possible.
And groups can come out there and pick apples?
So yes and no. You're welcome to come help us harvest. But like I said before, they're not culinary apples. So it's not a you pick orchard, right? So it's not something that you would come and grab apples and enjoy them in the orchard. They're definitely apples specific to making cider.
Oh boy. Now what about non-alcoholic for those of us who don't?
Yeah, absolutely. That is definitely a part of the plan. And, you know, for those out there, you've seen that non-alc and low-alc products are becoming more and more popular. We're 100% supportive of it. We love it. And we're also focused on an alternate line of High Mountain tonics, non-alcoholic tonics. So when you think about kind of like a tonic where you take essentially water, you do infusions with like herbs, botanicals, bittering agents, things like that, and create a tonic that can be nice, lovely, balanced drink on its own, or it could be a mixer and a cocktail or something like that, we will have a nice line of non-alc on the property as well.
And they'll be apple tonics, so I mean, you can actually use it and make an apple martini.
There you go. There you go. Now you're thinking, yeah. definitely we will be using apples and the apple juice, you know, for base blending on the tonics and things of that nature. We're still kind of getting into that R&D right now. We focused on the cider first and the fermentation R&D first. But you'll see kind of the back half of next year, we'll have a lot more details around the non-alc launch.
I really love it. So... what about apple cider? Right now everyone's loving apple cider. Is that just a simple jug, you know, gallon jug of apple cider? Is that out there, or is that more of a culinary apple that would do that?
Well, we'll have some fruit on the estate that can kind of play in both arenas, you know, on the culinary side as well as the cider side. And you use those in different blends when you create blended cider. And so when it's in season, when it's fresh, we absolutely plan to have like fresh sweet cider at the tasting room. It doesn't last, you know, it probably won't last all year, right? Because, you know, it's fresh, it's unpasteurized, there's lots of sugars in there. And so it's really a seasonal offering, but we'd like to highlight that at the tasting room when it's in season.
Outstanding.
And we'll also be able to do some kind of spin-off products as well, such as like an apple cider vinegar or applesauce. There's a few different areas that we can play in that we'll have available in our retail store within the tasting room.
I love it. We've just spent a few minutes with Brendan and Carly Coyle of Dendrick Estates. We are joined now by Rhonda Sedaris and Helena Sedaris of Park City Lodging, celebrating their 40th anniversary. Congratulations, 40 years in business. I need some, you know, tooting horns and little hand clappers, especially in this town. It's tough. We've gone through a few economic cycles, so you know what it's all about. Which one of you started it? Helena or Rhonda?
This will come as a shock to listeners everywhere.
Yeah, Helena's not 40. I started it, and I actually started it a little more than 40 years ago, but I started it out of my home, and I was just kind of doing it roguely. And Greg Scherf, the founder of Wasatch Breweries, he would not give me a check for one of his clients that was coming to town until I opened up a trust account. So I had to get legal. I went to our mayor at the time, Hal Taylor, and said, Hal, will you be my broker? And he said, honey, I'll be your broker as long as you don't screw me. And that's how I became legal 40 years ago.
Wow.
But thank you to Greg Scherf and to Hal Taylor.
Yeah. So what exactly does Park City Lodging do? Is it short term? Is it long term? Is it second home management?
Yeah, so we are a full-service property management company. We specialize in short-term vacation rentals, but we also offer second home management for non-rental purposes and HOA management. We are an amazing machine, to be totally honest with you. We have reservations, marketing, front desk, maintenance, housekeeping in-house, as well as a commercial laundry out of our building in Prospector Square. So we really kind of operate as an amazing little system. Yeah.
So VRBO came about in the late 90s. Excuse me. Airbnb a handful of years ago. Have they enhanced your business? Have they hurt your business? Or have they, my guess is they gave you a niche of, you know, quality management instead of, yeah, I got a couple of rooms, might as well rent it out. Is that how we're going?
Well, and before that, we had timeshares.
Right.
So we've gone through several different cycles here. I don't think it's hurt us at all. I mean, we've been able to pivot with change all the way throughout our 40 years. And I think that's been part of our success, is we don't have to answer to a big corporate office to get permission to do something. And it just has made us up our game, you know, from 9/11, the Olympics, COVID, the crash in 84, 85, the crash in 08, 09. All of those things have made us, I think, better. I have a great staff. Everybody there acts like they own the company, and they make decisions based on what's best for the client, be it the homeowner or the guest, and the company. So we're really fortunate in that. And we have been able to, I mean, some folks have left our management and gone on to manage their properties themselves, and then they come back because they don't want those phone calls at midnight. And that's what we do.
And, you know, it's interesting how Airbnb and VRBO have really broadened our audience and our scope, and how it's kind of become part of the cultural norm to want to travel to a vacation rental property instead of just a hotel. Mm-hmm. So it's really helped to also provide a different guest experience for the travelers that are coming to Park City that do want a kitchen and do want space to spread out and have their family here and eat meals in. And it's been interesting to see that evolve with the company as well. We implemented a complimentary concierge program maybe about a decade ago to try and meet that same level of service that the hotels were providing. And it's been a really interesting intersection of those two industries in bringing guests to Park City. And something I think we really try to focus on is not just giving them a place to stay and, you know, to operate out of, but really trying to fold them into the Park City community and helping our guests see a little bit of the magic and why we all love to live here.
Nice.
And how to respect it and practice mountain kind.
Exactly.
Yeah. Are your properties mostly slopeside, or do you have some like in Silver Creek or, you know, some of the gated communities?
They're all within the Park City Deer Valley area.
And canyons.
We don't manage out in Jeremy Ranch or Pine Brook or Silver Creek. And we've been asked, most recently, I just had a conversation with somebody I worked with 40 or 50 years ago who has a property. It's a beautiful property, but it's out in Pine Brook. And I said, you know, if I start managing a property out there and somebody calls and says the remote control is not working, we'll go, well, that's not that important. You know, it'll take me 30 minutes to get there. So our level of service decreases because we used to do that and we stopped doing it. We have to maintain our level of service because it doesn't matter. This is somebody's vacation. They spent hard money. You know, we are all experiencing time poverty. So they're taking their time out and I want to give them the best experience and I can't do that far out.
Time poverty? There's
time
a new
poverty.
Term.
Yeah.
Can you define that for me? I'm going
to
use
well,
it.
Well, we used to take 7-day vacations and now people take, you know, if they can get 3 days off or 4 days off, it's just because we all have.
It's the quickening pace and chaos of this world. Yeah. We're all busier every single week of our lives.
Yeah.
It's just, you know, ever increasing. So we really want to ensure that those that are able to take time out of their schedule to take a vacation to Park City, that it's just a high quality experience.
So you're able to do short 3 or 4 day rentals.
Absolutely.
Instead of 7 day.
Absolutely. Yeah. And the norm used to be Saturday to Saturday. Everybody checked in on Saturday. Everybody checked out on Saturday. And through some industry conferences, people were talking about it, that, well, maybe my guest now comes in on a Friday and it's not as big of a burden on housekeeping, or maybe they leave on a Sunday. And I think we were one of the first ones to not require a 7-night stay, and, you know, just for all of those reasons. So it's been kind of going on for a little while.
Yeah, it's been interesting to watch the traveler trends kind of evolve over the past few years, especially since COVID. And we're seeing that guests are, A, they're booking shorter vacations, maybe more frequently, and B, they're booking their vacations a lot closer to their arrival dates. And I think that is something else that Airbnb and VRBO and these other travel platforms have helped kind of shape that behavior. And people can be a little bit more spontaneous, which helps with that time poverty piece, because sometimes you get a free weekend when, you know, you didn't expect it.
Look at us. We're in D.C.
Yeah. And it's beautiful here. I'm looking out the window. A little bit of smoke from those fires. But, I'm going to come back to this in just a second. But first, there is a 40th anniversary celebration going on. Can one of you explain to listeners exactly what's going on?
Yeah, we can't have 40-year anniversary without a party. I mean, do you guys even know us? So we had a lot of different ideas on how to celebrate our 40 years. I talked with Rhonda, with my mom, a lot about maybe we could have a band and we could rent out this bar. And she said, you know, I saw this really inspiring documentary, sustainable documentary about a business, a carpet company going green, and I want to show that. So in true Rhonda fashion, we are renting out the Jim Santee Auditorium, one of our community's best assets. We are showing this film free of charge to the public. It'll be next Thursday at 7 p.m. at the Jim Santee Auditorium. The film is called Beyond Zero, and we'll have a little reception and party beforehand, and then there will also be a post-film discussion alongside with Park City Film Series.
Bring your bowl for your popcorn. You save a dollar and you get free refills, and then you don't have to use a paper cup.
And there's real butter.
And there's real butter, and you get to put it on yourself.
Wow. And that's next Thursday, October 10th?
Uh-huh.
Okay,
yeah.
October 10th.
And I hope that I didn't geek out too much and love this movie, and everybody else will. I think it's a great movie. It's just a great story, how some normal human being comes into work for this company and they set sustainability goals. And he goes, okay, we met that. Now let's move on. They're like, oh, no. Now we've got to set the next goal and it's got to exceed the last goal. And it was really inspiring how this person just embraced this. And it was the staff who pushed them. So.
No, is it, will the filmmakers be there for a Q&A afterwards or something like that?
No, the film series, we're putting together a panel right now of a few local businesses that are doing some really innovative and exciting things. So we're hoping to bring some enthusiasm and inspiration to the audience. Aside from the standard kind of sustainability approach, which is
excellent in and of itself, but entails, you know, recycling and other more manageable things. So we're hoping to bring some innovation and excitement into the room to help local business leaders take a different perspective on how they address sustainability within their own organizations.
And there's a lot of free prizes.
Yes.
Oh. So they're getting more than just a free admission, free prizes. I love it. And bring your own bowl for the popcorn. Now, circling back, so sustainability, you had mentioned you have numerous employees. Are they bringing sustainable ideas to you, sustainability ideas to you?
Yeah. And it's interesting because it's the people that you don't expect that come up with the best ideas. Our housekeeping managers or our maintenance managers, and that's probably those are probably the hardest departments to tap because they're not in the office, they're out in the field. So yes, they do bring lots to the table.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think that for Rhonda, I mean, at least being an employee of hers, speaking from this perspective, a lot of our business operations kind of come with an air of sustainability inherent to them. But it's been so cool to watch our staff become both educated and activated on the sustainability goals that we've implemented and having that shared conversation and those innovative talks and really bringing people to the table to help make those decisions moving forward, especially when it comes to operations. I think it gives people meaning in their work outside of, you know, your 9-to-5 and the task at hand, hopefully helping people feel like they can be a steward of the greater Park City community through their work.
Wonderful. Yeah. Well, we just spent a little bit of time this morning with Rhonda Sedaris and Helena Sedaris of Park City Lodging. If you want, you'll both be at the screening, right? So people can meet you?
Absolutely,
okay,
yes.
You can meet them next Thursday, October 10th, 7 p.m. over at Jim Santee Auditorium for Beyond Zero.